We're doing our class on the Jewish home, and we'll try to cover a few points because we're nearing the end of the semester. So, we're often better off if we set ourselves upper goals and lower goals. Meaning, we have our high aspirations, but we should also set ourselves minimums. And this is true in many settings. A person goes to yeshiva. So let's say a person says, I aspire to daven 3 times a day in minyan. That should be achievable in a yeshiva setting. But a person should also set a minimum. A person should tell himself, at least 4 times a week, I'll daven 3 times a day in a minyan. Or a person should say, at least I'll catch on Shabbos 3 tefillot a day with a minyan. Or at least I'll never miss a mincha with a minyan, because that's easy. I should be awake at that time. A person should try to set himself upper goals and lower goals. This is true in many settings. We're approaching Bein HaZmanim. We're approaching the break. So the break is a time when people very often spiral downward. A person can build the whole semester, and then during that month of the break, everything can unravel. So it's natural that we take a break. It's natural that without the yeshiva structure, it's more difficult to live up to our goals. And yet, a person should set an upper goal and a lower minimum. Tell yourself, during the break, I want to accomplish, I'll read Rabbi Beryl Wine's book on Jewish history, one of his books, two of his books. I'll take time to rest more. I'll get to bed on time. I'll take the time answering emails I haven't answered the whole semester, calling my parents and grandparents, wishing them a good Yom Tov, I'll catch up on letters. There are a lot of things a person can do. I'll go hike and discover Israel. There are a lot of things. I'll research the job opportunities I should be researching so I can make Aliyah properly. I'll try to start forging the contacts or the direction that will facilitate making Aliyah. You can make upper goals, great, but what are the lower goals? What's the minimum? What's the red line? I won't eat at a restaurant that doesn't have a hechsher. I'll be careful to daven, to put on tefillin every day. A person has to make lower minimums and upper goals. Now, the same thing is true in marriage. A person has to make upper goals. Where do I want to aspire to? I want to be like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, when he was burying his wife, he said, I know it's customary to ask our wives for forgiveness, but in all honesty, I don't think I have anything to ask you for forgiveness for. In all our years of marriage, I don't think I ever said or did anything that was not in accordance with halacha. I don't think I ever said something I have to apologize for. Wow! Now that's an upper goal. Okay, you can set that as your goal. To aspire your whole life never to say something improper to your wife. So they asked him afterwards, Rabbi, do you mean you never fought with your wife? And he said, of course we had arguments. Of course we disagreed. But I was always careful within the argument not to be personal. I never said something personally demeaning. I never even said, what's his line? He quoted a line. Something to the effect of, how can you say that? But I don't remember. He said, like a line that husbands often say when they're annoyed. What was the line? I don't remember. So okay, you could set that as an upper goal. You could set the upper goal, what Rav Aryeh Levine said when he came to the doctor, and he said, my wife's leg is hurting us. Us, yeah. It hurt him that his wife's leg hurt. Great. Set yourself upper goals. It's good to set your sights high, and then you work to get there. But there has to be a minimum. And there has to be a baseline where a person says, I don't fall from that. And the question is, where do you set that minimum? And I think there are certain things that have to be there. We have to give ourselves the slack that we will fluctuate. We won't be perfect in a marriage. We're a work in progress. We learn as we go along. We will have times that we get annoyed, and maybe we will not be Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach yet. Maybe in the beginning of marriage, we cannot guarantee that when we have arguments, we'll be as respectful as we should be, even though we should. We should work on it. We should try to be there. But there should be minimums. Okay, so let's discuss some minimums. One minimum is a person should never get physical. It seems obvious, right? But what happens when your wife smacks you? How do you respond? So I say that is the one time that I think it is right for a husband to walk out of the house. We haven't yet discussed it this year, but when a husband walks out of the house, that is one of the most powerful statements that a husband can make. It is one of the most hurtful things that a husband can do. And a husband might think, I just needed time to cool down. I didn't want to keep arguing, so I walked out. But to the wife, that is one of the most hurtful things you can do. Just walking out. You can walk to the park, go for a walk, cool off, come back. What you've just done is tremendously hurt your wife. But if what she's just done is become physical, which happens, and it sounds even humorous, but if a wife smacks her husband, anything the husband does is considered abuse. But what she just did is rarely considered abuse in her mind or anyone else's mind. So I don't think two wrongs make a right. I think that it's never right to be physical. And even if she started, walk away. Don't get divorced. I didn't say get divorced. I said walk away from the argument. Walk away from the fight. The message should be this is unacceptable. This doesn't happen in a marriage and this should never happen again. And with that, you walk out. You calm down. You cool off. She will apologize. She'll run after you. She'll whatever. But you're within your rights. But don't hit back. Don't yell back. What are you going to do? So it's wrong. She shouldn't do it. But you also shouldn't do it. And just because she started, let's not be little children. So step one of our minimums should be there shouldn't be physical violence. Okay? That should be obvious. I would take it to step two. What about slamming a door? What about banging on the table? I don't know. Is it the end of the world? I don't think it's a positive way of behaving. I apologize to our listeners. They just got that in their ear, and if they were listening on headphones, that wasn't pleasant. but it's not the end of the world. I mean, it's not a way we'd like to be behaving, right? You don't want to be the guy who slams his hand on the table. But, okay, it's not nice. It's not the dignified way we'd like to be, but it's not the end of the world. I don't know if that has to be a red line. What about profanity? To each his own. I don't think it's the right way to run a house. I think a person should get that out of his system. I don't think a person should use that. Is that a person's red line? You have to decide for yourself. What are going to be red lines? A person has to think, and a person has to define them, and then a person has to live up to them. Some people will say a red line is never go to debt. It's a good idea. Should that really be a red line? I don't know. Another person will say, never get drunk. So, okay, perm's around the corner. I personally believe that it is not proper to get drunk. A Jew is not supposed to get drunk. That's my personal belief. It happens to be a discussion among the commentaries that are shown him. There is the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. And generally, we Ashkenazim go with the Ramah, and the simple understanding is you drink more than you customarily drink, which for most people should be a little bit more than a cup of wine. How much do you drink on an average night, even on Shabbos? Let's say you drink a cup and a half of wine. It's okay, so you drink two cups of wine, three cups of wine, fine, but most people don't get drunk on three cups of wine, and then you go to sleep. So you did your obligation. So everyone wants to be Mehadrin suddenly. Great, let's be Mehadrin. Let's give the poor a little bit more food to eat on Purim. Let's make sure we give Mishloach Manos to those neighbors who won't get from anyone else, or the guy at the Machon who has no friends. Great, let's be Mehadrin. So you will see Bezrat Hashem next Thursday night. They give out a lot of wine here. There's limitless wine. And people do get drunk. And I'm not telling you, I personally think it's wrong, but say there. Obviously the Machon doesn't agree with me because they give out limitless wine here. And to each his own. But think about it. Think about how you're going to run your home. Think about what's important to you. Think about what you want in your home. I had an interesting thing this past week. Not in the Machon, in a different place. We were learning halacha, and I mentioned the halacha that when you make a blessing, you have to say it slowly, so you can have intent when you make the blessing. So someone raised their hand, a parent, and said, so if my child throws a blessing out quickly, Should I tell them to make the blessing all over again? Fair question? I don't think it's a fair question. So I said to them, you know, I think that when it comes to being God-fearing people, that's not something that you should correct your child about. Teach them by example. If you make a blessing the way you should, then your child might learn and might not learn from it. But by correcting them, telling your child that her bracha wasn't a good bracha, do it all over again, I don't think that's the way you teach a person to connect the blessings. Teach by example. So now let me ask you, how do you want to see your 15-year-old? You want to see them drinking on Purim and getting stoned? You decide. Right now you're thinking about you. But let's go the next step. You're going to be a parent. Where do you want to see your children? Your question. But don't go telling the kid you shouldn't be drinking Purim when you're going to drink Purim. So okay guys, you could say I'm at the Machon. This is my year, let me have a good time. I'm not telling you what to do this year. I'm telling you this is our class on the Jewish home. Think long term. Where do you want to go? What type of home do you want to build? Look, I'm chicken. I'll be very straight with you. I don't get drunk because I don't know what I'll do when I get drunk. I'm very scared. I don't know what I'll do, what I'll say. I'm not willing to take that risk. So sometimes I say those people who get drunk, I have respect for them because they obviously aren't too scared. They don't have what to hide. I have what to hide. I'm not interested in telling everyone my secrets.
I heard your big secret was that you read
Shaft
over 40
times. How have I? No, seriously. I want you to take the responsibility of long term and ask yourself, okay, what are the limits? What are the limits in our home? And ask yourself, what would happen if your wife came home stoned? Let's take another question, safety. What happens if your spouse is going to drink and drive? She's going to take the kids for a ride. Let's go enjoy the nighttime air. She just had 3 drinks. Come on, I'm okay. Would you accept that? So now let's ask ourselves, is that supposed to be our red line? Think about it. Now let's take it to another realm, to the realm of honesty, to the realm of decency, to the realm of religion. What is our red line within our home? I don't think a red line has to be, I will wake up for Minyan every morning. I don't think so. That's not a red line, it's an aspiration. Get there, good, I'm all for it. But what's the red line? I will keep Shabbos. What's your red line? And here I want to diverge for a minute. Even though our class is really focused on post-marriage, all of you not all of you, but we are talking about a situation where you're dating, you're not yet married. So I think that we'll diverge for 1 second. We'll digress for 1 second. This question, to my mind, is a pivotal question when you're starting to date as well. What's your red line? What's your minimum? What do you demand of yourself and you expect never to go beneath that line? It's a question you have to ask yourself. You have to set it up. And it's a setup within the home as well. And I don't think a person should date before they have answered that question. From a religious perspective here and from an ethical perspective, you owe it to one another. You have to know who you are. Define yourself if you aren't yet defined. So wait till you are and then start dating. But I gave a few examples. I'm not sure that I know of so many more examples. But I think a person has to draw that minimum. And a person has to draw that maximum. Where do I want to get to? So that maximum is also important. It's part of our dreams. So I met a couple that matched on that maximum. They both wanted to adopt as many pets as possible. So they had snails and scorpions and spiders and snakes and rabbits and who knows what growing up in their house. But it was a shared dream. You know, I once wanted to joke with them, but I didn't have the courage to. I wanted to ask them, do they grow lice on themselves and in their beds as well? You know, you're growing everything else. What about that? You know, you want to feed the planet. Are you letting lice feed off of you too? But okay, you know what? Each their own. I never wanted to visit their house. It was scary for me. I never knew what was hanging from what. You know, the husband would walk in the street with a snake draped around his neck. And he'd have the snake around his arm, and he'd wave to me. And I was scared to wave back, like I'd cross the other side of the street. You know, it's a little bit scary. But fine, you know, each his own. What difference does it make? So at any rate, sharing dreams is important, and having aspirations is important. You've got to set the minimum, you've got to set where you're headed to. So that was point number one I wanted us to discuss tonight, which I think is important. Important to set our minimums. Let's go over to point number two, which is a slight offshoot. We like to think that because our spouse is going to be our best friend, so of course our spouse will get the best treatment. Right. We'd like to think that, and that's where we have to build towards. But the way to get there is very difficult. You know, one of the first complaints that happen after you're married is, this isn't easy. She is not an easy person to build with. He is not an easy person to build with. This marriage thing, I guess other people have it easier than I do, because this is really hard. And this is a standard complaint. You know, everyone, after a few months, everyone comes to the realization that no one has it as hard as they do. They look around and they say, I've seen normal relationships. No one has it as bad as I do. Everyone's convinced that, and that's why everyone's on the brink of divorce pretty fast after they get married. And in our generation, people actually do it pretty fast after they're married. If people can hold out, so then if they hold out long enough, then they start rebuilding. You know, there's a cycle in the relationship. There's infatuation, you know, there's excitement, revelation, and then there's disenchantment. You suddenly say, huh? Oh, no. Okay, fine. So we come to a challenge. The challenge is, question number one, can you hate someone you love? So even though some works say you cannot, I think the answer is you can. I don't think hate and love are mutually exclusive. You could love the person on some levels, and you could hate the person on other levels. The two work in unison. And then a person is shocked. How could I hate my wife? But the rage that brews in a person when they're in the first year of marriage, second year of marriage, third year of marriage, and suddenly they have to deal with this person on a daily basis, and their weakness is so difficult to deal with because we all have those human weaknesses. We have our shortcomings. And when I'm up close with someone else's weakness, oh, that's really hard to deal with. I can deal with everyone else's weakness because I don't have to live under the same roof as them. But when I have to live under the same roof as someone, their weakness becomes earth-shattering. It's not livable. Really. But you know what? It's not livable to live with us either. If you have to live under the same roof. So how does marriage work? Marriage works because we're accepting. We're accepting? How could I be accepting of that? Right. We're accepting where it's difficult to be accepting. And every person has those wonderful surprises in marriage where they have to be accepting of things that were not anticipated. When I can learn to be accepting, I can learn to love, I can learn to connect. To be accepting of shortcomings that I was not prepared for. But in the process, there is a minimum demand we should make of ourselves. And that is that we will treat our wives no less than, I can say two conclusions to that sentence. No less than our regular friend, or no less than a stranger on the street. And you choose which ending you want to put to that sentence. But make a commitment to yourself. I will never treat my wife less than, okay, let's take the minimum, less than a stranger on the street. Would you yell at a stranger on the street? I sure hope not. Would you deride a stranger on the street? Would you say derogatory things about a stranger on the street? I hope not. So then suddenly within marriage, you have to ask yourself a very grueling question. Is my spouse getting the treatment, the minimum treatment that I would give a stranger on the street? And the answer to that is very tough. So this is a minimum demand we should make of ourselves, which is not as easy as it sounds. It's not, but it's important, and it helps us maintain focus. I'm going to give them the minimum. Now, I think we should also make a demand of ourselves to give dignity to our spouse. People sometimes have confused questions Where does dignity end? So I want to share with you guys, you're in advanced class, I want to share with you a halacha that sheds a lot of insight. I've never done this before in a class, but you guys are a very mature class, we can do this. There's a halacha about intimacy. When a couple's going to be intimate in the bedroom, So most things are permissible. Whatever the two want to do, they can do. There's very few limitations in halacha about what the couple can do. We know there are the laws of family purity, when they're permitted and when they're prohibited. But then there are a few limitations. So one limitation is that the halacha says that in the room, there has to be darkness. Why does it have to be dark in the room? So two reasons. We'll discuss one of those reasons. There are two halachic reasons. One halachic reason is that the woman will possibly be uncomfortable if she feels like she is being seen. It could be that in order for her to be comfortable in the bedroom, she needs that privacy of feeling like it's dark. So the halacha says we have to be careful. It's not only, there are other halachic reasons for it. But there's also this, what the Gemara calls, "Ve'ahavta le'racha kamocha," love your fellow man as yourself, and for sure your wife. And that means that if she might be uncomfortable and she won't be able to be into things because she senses that she's seen, so then you're not allowed to. That's the halacha. All of the Jewish people, when they're intimate in the bedroom, there's darkness. Look at how the halacha wanted us to be sensitive. She should be given that dignity. If she might be uncomfortable, she might think, my husband didn't notice I gained weight, but now he will. My husband never knew I had a mole over here, but now he will. So comes the halacha and says, give her that dignity. There's a basic dignity. Don't make her do something she's uncomfortable with. And even though she didn't ask for it, comes the halacha and demands it of us. The halacha says, do it. Give her that dignity. Even if she didn't ask for it. Even if she says, yeah, whatever, however you want. No? The halacha overrides it. The halacha says, no one asked her. On this one, she might not be comfortable telling you what she really wants. So that's an insight. How the halacha wanted us to be sensitive. And husbands make a big mistake. They ask a question. Let me give you two scenarios. Scenario number one, a 55-year-old man gets on the bus. The bus is packed. And he has a whitish beard. It's not yet fully white. And he's carrying his goods. And it's a Thursday night, and the bus is packed. And he's swaying on the bus as the bus is moving. So a young man gets up and tells him, sir, would you like to sit down? Sir, do you want to sit down? Sir, do you want my seat? Is that nice? What do you guys say? What score does he get on a scale of 1 to 10? 10 being the best?
He's a nice guy, but he's still not considered. He doesn't want to be asked. He's embarrassed to be told you're an old man. Sit down.
So there are two ways to offer someone something. I learned this lesson when I had a guest on Rosh Hashanah night one year. I did not have the sensitivity to this. So I took the serving plate and I asked him, can I give you? I thought I was being sensitive. And he said to me, you're the host, you start giving, and when I won't want, I'll say stop. So I still didn't get what he was saying. So I asked him, what do you mean? See, he was nice. He explained it to me. He said, when you ask someone, do you want, they have to undergo that shame of saying, I want, please give me. What you should do as a host is give. And when they want you to stop, they'll tell you stop. And if they don't want, they'll say, I don't want. A person's cognizant. But don't make a person have to tell you, I want. So the same is true on the bus. How many times do people say, I made this mistake just the other week? No much, a week or two ago, someone got on the bus. I was working. I didn't want to get up. So I said, do you want to sit down? So a young man standing next to the old person said a very nice line to me. He said, of course he wants to sit down. Everyone wants to sit down. He's right. The nice way to do it is to get up and say, Bechavod. You want to give the guy the seat? Don't make him beg. But us men, we do this all the time. We ask, do you want? So then the other person has to say, yes, I want. A woman is intrinsically more modest than a man. A woman doesn't want to say, I want. The Gemara words it as, Isha tovat balev. A woman yearns for something in her heart, but she doesn't want to ask for it. She wants you to offer it. That's why we call it to be a gentleman. To offer it. But not to offer it with the question. One of the mistakes we make is we ask, do you want? She doesn't want to say, I want. And there are many things, and this is one of the big mistakes that men make, that there are many things that a woman wants, but she's not going to tell you. So men get frustrated. Why are you so complicated? Why don't you just tell me what you want? That's one of the classical lines in marriage. No, that's because she's a woman. It's not complicated. It's part of the internal modesty. Hashem created her that things are more internal by her. In Kabbalistic terms, we say that the... I don't know Kabbalah, but I heard this in a shir once. That was for you. The way... So he wants to know what shir. To know I really don't learn Kabbalah. So it's one of the shirim of Rabbi Akiva Tatz, okay? So now you know. I'm Ashkenazi. I don't learn Kabbalah. At any rate, not at this age anyways. They say that the human form reflects the nature of the soul. And just like the male human form, the male private parts are protruding. It's not modest. And by a woman, everything's internal. Her ovaries, everything's inside. That's the nature of the soul as well. Where the soul is modest, everything is folded inward. Nothing's protruding. The man lays his card on the table. This is what I want. Very simple. Ish tovah bepeh, the Gemara says, man is very open about what he wants. A woman wants you to figure it out, but that's part of her nature. It's part of her modest nature. There's nothing wrong with it. So when we want to offer something, we have to offer it in a way that doesn't force her to come out and say, yes, I want that. So that's not natural to us, but okay, that's one of the things we have to learn. What did we discuss today? We discussed setting for ourselves minimums. Red lines, draw red lines. We discussed that one of those red lines should also be not to treat our wife less than a stranger on the street. And we discussed that when we offer something and when we want to give something, so then with regards to a guest and certainly with regards to our wife, we have to get accustomed to doing it in a way that doesn't force them to say, I want, but rather offers it in a way that doesn't force that, and yet leaves them the option of refusing. That's a talent we have to develop.